the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast is just two guys and maybe a guest or two discussing Bitcoin, Bitcoin equities, and the related macroeconomic space. It's not meant to be financial advice, so please, if you're doing any investing after listening to our program, do your own research, do your own due diligence, and understand that any money you invest can be lost. The show is meant for entertainment purposes only, and we hope you enjoy the program. Friends and enemies, welcome to a very messy hair edition of the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast. Another Wednesday night interview tonight. My name is Joey, and we're coming to you tonight with Mark Goodwin, Bitcoin Magazine, The Bitcoin Dollar, his upcoming book. We're looking forward to talking about that. Before we start, as always, first of all, go Raptors. Tonight's the play-in game, which I'll be watching when Mark and I are finished. But also our sponsor, EasyDNS, best place for you to host your domain, friends. If you don't want to get canceled, okay, by someone who doesn't like your opinion on central banking, someone who doesn't like your opinion on protests, someone who doesn't like your opinion on, I don't know, modern economics. I think those times might be coming. Honestly, I don't know when, but I think they're coming. And you want to be part of a service that will make sure that you're unassailable. And that's the title of Mark Jeftovic, the sole proprietor and co-founder of EasyDNS. His book from many years ago. And that's something that we take seriously here at Canadian Bitcoiners Podcast. We obviously have been pretty open about our struggles finding a bank account for the show. And, you know, among other things, we've done a lot of dancing on a lot of different kinds of thin ice over the 2 years we've been doing the program. So if you're looking for something like that, get in touch with Mark. We have a promo code. I forget what it is. I should also mention tonight that I forgot on Monday's show, we're supposed to give away a ticket to the Canadian Bitcoin Conference. I won't forget that for next week. Monday, we'll give away a ticket, and Len and I will be there eating steaks, taking pictures, and I guarantee that at least one of the 2 days, Saturday or Sunday, I will show up with a hangover, and I hope you do too. So with all that said, let's bring in Mark Goodwin. Mark is here coming to us from parts unknown, the blurry background. We talked about it a little bit before the show. Unknown whether it is an issue with squalor or valuables. We don't know, but he's a man who's been doing the tour. Now, I gotta congratulate you before we start here on getting onto Preston Pish's show. That is a landmark moment. And I'll tell you, okay, between two guys who are familiar with content, we just had him on last week, Wednesday night.
Yeah.
And I don't get nervous talking to anybody. And re-listening to that interview, I was nervous. And listening to you, after listening to you other places, you were nervous too talking to him. That guy brings it out of you because he is a legend. He's a guy who's part of everyone's formative journey,
dude,
man.
Dude, for real. First off, huge shout out to Preston. Love Preston. You know, been listening to him for years. And yeah, absolutely an honor to be on there. Felt the same way on Stefan's, same way on WBD. But you're totally right on the call out for the nervousness thing. And man, dude, like, it's a thing I'm working on because, yeah, it's like, you know, you don't want to, you know, if you're talking about some pretty high level stuff with people that really know their shit, it's like, you don't want to say fucking something stupid on, in front of your boy or whatever. It's taken me a little, you know, going through the ringer a little bit just to sort of like, you know, just relax, you know, relax. It's all right. You know, it's like, someone wants to talk Bitcoin with you. That's the greatest thing in the world. It's going to be fun. And so I'm learning to relax a little bit getting into the pod, but good call out. You're completely right, man. 100%. 100%.
Hey, listen,
right.
I got to tell you, like, you're, I think, I would call you a sort of natural speaker, right? It's hard to have ideas formulate in your mind, get them out in words that make sense. And, you know, kind of be agile during a conversation, especially when there's a little bit of latency or you had a long day or the topic is something as deep as Bitcoin. But it is funny when Preston gets involved. Mm-hmm. Holy man, like I couldn't believe it. And I was happy to see you on there. You deserve to be on there. I'm happy to see that he's getting some guests that are talking about the right things, because it's easy to get guests who are talking about the wrong things. Now, we are going to talk about some of those things tonight. First, though, Mark Goodwin, who are you?
Yeah.
What do you do? How did you get into Bitcoin?
Yeah, totally. Mark Goodwin. I am the director of editorial for The Print at Bitcoin Magazine. Been in Bitcoin, 5-6 years. I was introduced to it really oddly. I was just working in the hospitality industry in San Francisco, and the guy that took over for Ross put up Silk Road 2.0 right after it got shut down was a regular at my bar. So he brought up Bitcoin to me, and end of 2014. And I didn't bring up any of the monetary policy stuff, just medium of exchange shit, you know? And then at the beginning of 2017, when everything was starting to pop off, I was like, wait, it can go up in price? Like, wait, hold on. Okay. And then, yeah, been kind of hooked ever since. And yeah, was lucky being in the Bay. It's like, there's so much Bitcoin activity here, which is how I, you know, just going to meetups, shout out to Bay Area Bitcoiners. Going to Bitcoin meetups can absolutely change your life. I can attest to that. My favorite people in the world, my best friends, the people that were, you know, there for me during this crazy last couple of years, especially in the Bay with all the lockdowns and bullshit. Yeah. Those are my people. Met CK, met a bunch of the Bitcoin Magazine crew, and just started writing. I wrote a piece called The Birth of the Bitcoin Dollar, which kind of started this whole trope that led to this book that I'm about to, you know, put out this year that we'll talk about, I'm sure. And then, yeah, I just got kind of sucked in right away and was writing for them for a few months. And then they brought me on to work on the print mag. So, yeah, I'm still out here in the Bay Area and, yeah, working for Bitcoin Magazine full time. And, yeah, just still completely, completely obsessed with Bitcoin. It doesn't stop at all. you know, really enjoying getting into some of the high level privacy, technical stuff, you know, the things I can dip my noob toes into. And then, of course, you know, we're big macro boys and getting into the dollar and the banking system and all that. It's just endless. So, yeah, nonstop research. And yeah, I'm happy to be here with I didn't get a friends and enemies coming on, but that's all right. that's all right. I was checking you guys out your latest stream on Monday. And at the beginning, you guys were talking about, you're like, oh, I can't wait. It's going to be 24 degrees tomorrow or something. And it took me a second. I was like, man, this Canadians are savage. They're like excited about 20. Oh, yeah. Celsius. Right.
It's nice here, man. It's very nice. And I did give you a friends and enemies. I always give the friends and enemies to start.
Okay.
We're going to see where you land. Mark, one of the other things, I like to look at when I watch the videos and listen to stuff about guests that are coming on, I've noticed that you have a collection of hats. That's there's like a diplomatic way to put this. I'll use the word eclectic. I saw an 8-bit Pepe today. You got the Ordinals cap.
Yeah.
I wasn't gonna ask about Ordinals, but we'll get there. First, let's talk a little bit about this Bitcoin dollar thesis you have. Yeah. This is interesting to me because part of me says this is too close to the system we have now. We're pegging something to the Bitcoin network, and I prefer to use layer ones. I think a lot of people are like, well, Lightning maybe, something else maybe, stuff that's not developed yet maybe, gold something, I don't know. A lot of people have these thoughts, especially new Bitcoiners. And so tell me a bit about your Bitcoin dollar thesis, and then we'll dive into the book, why you're writing it, and we'll go from there. So what do you think, 30,000 feet on this idea of the Bitcoin dollar?
Yeah, totally. I think, yeah, there's great reason for skepticism for like one-to-one pegging and some of these ideas. You know, hey, people should build whatever they want, you know, go check it out. But the actual Bitcoin dollar doesn't really have anything to do with the literal physical mechanisms of pegging. You know, a dollar to Bitcoin or Taro or any of that stuff. And it has much more to do with, it's more of an analog to like the petrodollar. So this idea of tying, you know, the ins and outs of an energy-based commodity, you know, basically a monopoly in the petrodollar scenario anyway. But, you know, making those ins and outs of this incredibly necessary, you know, any economy that wanted to industrialize in the last 50 years, you know, obviously, or was already industrialized, you know, needs oil. So by, you know, kind of doing this partnership with Saudi Arabia and obviously our military involvement in the Middle East, we were able to set up a pretty good, you know, not perfect, of course, and certainly the Bitcoin dollar isn't perfect either, but, you know, a pretty good monopoly on the market for oil and pricing it in dollars. And so the idea is basically that, you know, the petrodollar in effect died in March of 2020. When we had that huge spike down and oil went negative and we just had that crazy futures market. I mean, that's just, it was such an anomaly thing. And then of course we see Bitcoin, you know, 20X in the year. And then, you know, we've seen what we've seen with the higher interest rates, you know, in the last year. And we've seen the Dixie, you know, relatively, you know, the dollar just crushing, you know, global currencies, the pound almost going below a dollar, you know, the euro actually going below a dollar. So yeah, the idea of, yeah, basically what we kind of have, if you really want to be honest and look at the Bitcoin system, I mean, it's in the high 90% of all volume and trading pairs are US dollars. You know, we've kind of created that similar mechanism, as we're, you know, obviously dealing with high inflationary times. And so if the US dollar system has taught us anything, it's going to preserve like the general purchasing power of the economy and not care as much about the specific purchasing costs of the dollar with its, you know, inflation targeting. So, you know, where are they going to put that high inflationary effects, you know, like what they did in the 70s when they created the petrodollar? It's like, well, they can shovel it into Bitcoin, ins and outs, and, you know, the banking system around Bitcoin, they can shovel it, you know. The real crux of it is that it's not really the dollar that's necessarily the reserve asset of the world. It's these T-bills and these treasuries that, right, you know, uphold the system. And, you know, who's actually left to buy these T-bills? And stablecoin providers and issuers have been some of the biggest buyers. And of course, you know, anyone looking for these high interest rate, you know, yields are lapping them up. And so that's, you know, you know, it makes a ton of sense, but, you know, eventually there's going to have to be some sort of form of printing to deal with this high interest rate, high debt service scenario. Eventually those two are going to hit each other. So there will have to be some sort of printing to get out of this at some point. I think interest rates will probably go higher and longer than people want. You know, us Bitcoin doomer accelerationists want everything to break yesterday. But, you know, eventually that's going to have to happen. And, you know, where can we shovel these inflationary effects? Where can we get users? We can globalize the dollar, dollarize the world even faster with electronic rails. And we can go sell basically government debt to stablecoin users in Indonesia that want to come in and out of Bitcoin. And, you know, that's more or less the 30,000 feet look at the Bitcoin dollar thesis. But there's obviously a lot of nuance there and potentially some stretches, but I think it makes a lot of sense, and it has been more or less, you know, kind of playing out.
I think it's playing out so far. Now, you said something that's interesting, and I've heard this, you know, maybe not in those exact words, Mark, but other people kind of hint at this. They tiptoe around it or near it. The petrodollar is dead. Mm-hmm. And died in 2020 with this, you know, a super weird price action in oil. And since then has never really truly recovered. You mentioned some of the other currency weakness around the world. Tell me, if you can, why you think the petrodollar was dead at that moment, and why you think some people, even in Bitcoin, I suspect would disagree with you. Because I know there's people who think the dollar, you know, dollar milkshake theory is still on its way to playing out. The US dollar will remain the strongest currency while the others perish, et cetera, et cetera. What do you think? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think that's true. I think the dollar milkshake theory is true to a point. And also, I think it will rapidly appreciate against other global currencies while also still having to deal with its very own mathematical issues. You know, the compounding debt service is real. I mean, that's a mathematical issue. And I think the reason why people look at March 2020, and certainly why I do, as being this moment is, I mean, A, we saw the huge movement, this abnormality in the futures markets of oil, obviously, you know, pandemic related, of course. But, you know, a couple months later was a very important mathematical moment in Bitcoin, which was, you know, the third halving, which is where we took supply issuance down, you know, obviously in half, but relatively that meant that, you know, we were now around 2%, sub 2% of relative issuance, which, you know, is obviously less than the 2%, you know, that is the target of inflation that, you know, is the Fed's mandate, and also around a little bit under the rate of gold extraction. So these are kind of like, you know, two pretty big metrics of economic growth that, you know, mathematically Bitcoin is actually issuing less than these two, you know, standards. And so I think when you see a mathematical truth like that, you see a humongous amount of dollar printing. I mean, we saw 70% of dollars, you know, of M1 supply was like printed, you know, it's just absurd, at least since 2008. And, you know, there's a mathematical truth to that the dollar can remain, you know, having leverage over the global economy while also being over leveraged against itself. And, you know, I've said this before, but it kind of feels like that was the moment where the dollar ran off the cliff, like the road runner running off the cliff, and Wile E. Coyote's coming and runs and is still running and still in the air, but is very clearly has no solid footing underneath him. And I think that is sort of been where we are. So there's also a lot of crazy mechanism changes going on you know, with the European dollar market, with the euro dollar market. You know, LIBOR, this London interbank overnight rate kind of being pretty disconnected from the US dollar system, with only JP Morgan being the only bank represented as an American bank. And we're seeing the Fed, you know, doing a lot of creative things to sort of crush the demand of that market, which is a huge part of the dollar system, you know, worldwide, of course. And credit is, you know, created by people buying these T-bills and then creating dollars on top of them. And the euro dollar was kind of its own market that I think, you know, you could argue the Fed is trying to get after. And so now we're seeing, you know, increases in this, you know, the securitized, you know, overnight federal rate, the SOFR, which is basically kind of kind of replacing the LIBOR as this overnight security rate, this yield for regional and big American banks. And so we're seeing kind of the dollar coming back onshore in this kind of strange way. So all of this stuff is happening in the dollar system. And, you know, then we're looking politically, sociopolitically, and, you know, what does the U.S. do? It just literally waltzes out of Afghanistan as if, you know, it wasn't waging war in there for a decade or whatever. You know, why would we give up, you know, if we're at this very important time where, you know, we're going through our oil reserves? It's like, why would we kind of give up this lever in the Middle East if there wasn't a fundamental change happening underneath? So I look at all those things, you know, zoomed out, and I see that there's some sort of big change here. And so, yeah, I start to piece those mathematical truths together with a little bit of political speculation. And, you know, that more or less, you know, coalesces to the Bitcoin dollar thesis. So I don't know if that quite answered your question about if I, you know, is the dollar milkshake theory playing out or not? Like, I think it is. I don't think it will forever. But it depends. There's some nuances within that argument, within the dollar milkshake, where I think the dollar will continue to appreciate again against global currencies, but will depreciate against Bitcoin and probably hard assets as well, probably gold as well. Although I'm not really a gold bug, but
I think you're probably right. I do see dollar milkshake continuing to play out. I'm glad we agree on that. I know that there's been sometimes on the Monday show, we talk about that and the crowd doesn't always agree with the dollar milkshake theory. I think it's self-evident at this point that it's playing out. Now, one thing you didn't mention there in all the tectonic shifts is the, I think, I don't want to say attempt. I think what we're seeing is a very deliberate strategic move by several nations who are incentivized to get out from under U.S. dollar hegemony to push their own currency backed by some basket commodities.
Great
so do you have a view on this stuff? This is something that's pretty popular in Bitcoin, Mark, and you know this. I'm not breaking any news to you, but I don't know how concerned we should be about that, if that's a problem for now or 5 years or 10 years. It sounds like you've probably given this some thought, if I had to guess. So I'm interested in hearing what you think about that.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, you know, I didn't think about it. But, you know, I think we've seen a lot of those developments sort of after that moment. And we saw some weird ass shit, man. Like we saw petro futures settled in euros between Russia and China. It's like, I mean, can you imagine like that headline 10 years ago or something? I mean, it's just, it's so absurd. And so, yeah, I mean, yeah, you're totally right. I think it's more of a symptom of the pushback against the Fed and against the dollar. I don't know how much the dollar's pretty pervasive. It's pretty strong. It's going to survive. I don't know how much I really fear some of the BRICS stuff. Or like, you know, an attempt to move to a gold-backed currency again or something. Like, I really do think, you know, the dollar, you know, will do a creative technical thing to sort of kick its economic hegemon, you know, sort of down the road, like they did with the petrodollar. I mean, a genius economic move if you ignore all of the horrible, unethical, moral stuff. I mean, I'm sort of serious in a weird way. I mean, I'm very anti the dollar system and, you know, obviously I hate the state in so many ways. But you know, you got to tip your hat sometimes, you know, I mean, it was a smart idea. And I think that Bitcoin is so, you know, ready to take that mantle, from oil, in a very fundamentally different way, of course. But yeah, I mean, yeah, you got to look at the BRICS stuff. You got to look at this, you know, there's a de-dollarization attempt going on by some of the biggest world powers, while also there's a decentralized economic monetary policy revolution happening in Bitcoin, you know, and then there's still gold, which is still tied to the BRICS stuff. But it's like there's a lot of sharks in the water around the dollar. And, you know, you definitely can't ignore that. The market isn't ignoring it. You know, the market can get spooked by things, and creditors can do bank runs and thing, and, you know, pull their deposits out and stuff like that can all happen. And so we're in. Yeah. I mean, I'm a big Luke Gromen guy. I think he's fantastic. I think his books are great. And, you know, he starts off like all of his things being like, this is uncharted territory. No one has gone through this kind of trading, so don't expect to get it all right. And, you know, it's like we're all learning. And it has been kind of cool, you know, going back to the Preston stuff and, you know, seeing you guys talk and, you know, me and you exchanging shit on Twitter. Like, it's cool to see this kind of like everybody, you know, picking apart the carcass of the news and being like, oh, this makes sense. This is important. This is whatever. And everyone's sharing it in this kind of strange way. So I think we're all figuring it out. It's the banking system is complicated on purpose. There's a lot of obscurity on purpose. And I'm a big proponent of saying that Bitcoin is transparency technology, and its main thing that will do will prevent obfuscation, which is the biggest problem in the dollar system. And I know that's not necessarily popular with a lot of cypherpunks, but it's like, it's an open ledger. We can see everything. There's a lot of beauty in that in a lot of ways as well, especially if you get to a point where, you know, a lot of people are priced out from holding UTXOs. And it does maybe coalesce to more, you know, bank settlement. You know, this could become a central bank settlement network with like 100,000 of us whales or whatever, you know, and that could be the future. And in which case, is it better to have a kind of a more transparent base layer from an economic standpoint? So yeah, we'll see. It's gonna be fun. But yeah, there are people coming after the dollar for sure. They'll try.
There's a lot of good comments there that I liked. One that I've thought about a little bit, and I'm with you on the obfuscation as a deliberate tool to discourage people from looking into the banking system. I think that's pretty clear at this point.
Yeah.
The thing that you mentioned there that I have been a fan of and I've talked about is the role that something like Twitter, you know, maybe Nostr down the road, though not quite yet, plays in the downfall of a modern economy. And it's going to play a role, sure, right? You can imagine the day that everyone realizes that at BTC 100K US or whatever, that the fire alarm, to use the term Luke Gromen likes to use,
sure,
the fire alarms are going off, right? And yeah, people in 08, you know, I was still posting pictures of me at the bar on Facebook in 08, man. I didn't have a Twitter that was kind of streaming constant topics that I was looking for, mm-hmm, from the general population as opposed to just my friends, Twitter Spaces, the podcast. It seems to me like this is going to play a major role. Now, I'm curious about whether you think that's a good thing or a bad thing. And the reason I ask is because, again, like I'm giving a nod to the CBP audience here, but every show now, it seems like I have people in my chat saying acceleration and accelerationist, like with spaces, mm-hmm, in between every letter, like the aesthetic acceleration poster. And like, I don't know how I feel about this stuff, honestly, because I can imagine a world where like the transition is brutal. It's swift 100%. And it's 100% unforgiving, right? And so,
yeah,
do you think that this is like the Twitter could be a net positive, net negative? Is the state going to go after Twitter? We're going to go into the state's role in all this next. I think you and I share some some common ground there.
But I mean,
like, what do you think the outcome is with stuff like this? Communication wasn't around like this 15 years ago. Now it's the only thing people look at.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the world has changed. I mean, I definitely look at Bitcoin as downstream from the internet revolution. You know, like Bitcoin couldn't exist without the internet. And there's a whole new, like, we're a new species, man. It's like we have a complete new connectivity to each other and to the global history of mankind, you know, like, or at least recorded history, and we can connect to it instantly. You know, there's two sides to that coin. There's one where, yeah, I can, you know, video chat up with my pal in Canada and I can be like, oh, hey, the US is showing a bunch of propaganda movies about how Canadians are weird and they suck and we got to go kill them. And is that true? And then you can be like, no, that's not true. We don't hate you at all. And I'll be, oh, okay, cool. You know, but in the 40s, like, that literally worked. And it's insane what they did, you know, from a propaganda standpoint. So that interconnectivity has destroyed that ability for centralized propaganda, but also it's created new pathways to just digest an infinite amount of it. You know, there's always content and there's always propaganda. But yeah, communication tools are changing everything. And like, you know, there are revolutions and there are things that can come downstream just from technological connectivity. And I think Bitcoin is that. It's downstream from the internet. Yeah, but like how messed up is it going to be if hyper-Bitcoinization happens tomorrow? Horrible. I mean, like, yes, there's a part of me that hates everything, wants it all to burn down. Let's just rip this Band-Aid off and just take away this pus tumor that is the Federal Reserve System and go bury it in the backyard. But what would that actually mean? It would be horrible. I mean, so there's millions of people that rely on the US dollar every day to be fed. And then there's, of course, the people that save and have their entire life, whether it's in their business, their real estate, or just literal their savings in the US dollar system. And most of those people are people we love and are our family and our friends. And, you know, I'm sure we've all done a pretty damn good job of orange pilling the people we really needed to, or we've stacked some for them. And then maybe they caught up a couple years later or whatever. But it's like, no, like it's not good for not Bitcoiners. And then also for Bitcoiners, it's less time to stack. You know, so I don't know. I go both ways. And I think it's interesting that you brought it up with in regards to the connectivity of, you know, sort of this information warfare kind of thing, because like, I think that is there's a bigger revolution kind of happening of thought and of people coming together that are connected by a common thing. And then they realize they have all these other common interests. And I think that's something I'm really excited to see, before we have financial, you know, we have to deal with these financial problems, but like, let's get people together to build some of these solutions so that, you know, like we're basically buying time now until, you know, we have to, you know, deal with our compounding debt service. And what can we build in that time to make sure that we're prepared to take care of the billions of people that won't own UTXOs and will never be able to own UTXOs? How do we build layers where they can still have access to immutable, stable monetary policy, but not actually own a UTXO? You know, we can build those tools. And I say we very liberally, but very smart people can build those tools and we can talk about them. But, you know, we should take advantage of, you know, this kind of new sense of community and new thought that's coming out. You know, we're all post everything. Like we're post, it's not just post left or post right. It's like post fucking post politics, post whatever. It's like we know that system is rotting and dying. And we're jumping from the carcass to a new raft, but we haven't finished building the raft yet, you know? And it's like, there's a lot of things we take for granted in Bitcoin, especially, that, you know, and I'm obviously incredibly bullish on Bitcoin and it is the raft I am swimming towards, you know, but there's a lot to do. And I hope that we have more time to do it, so that we're really ready. I do think we're ready in a lot of ways, that we would be able to handle an economic banking catastrophe or something like that. You know, I think the Bitcoin network is very strong, but Bitcoiners versus the state isn't just going to die and disappear, you know, like they're going to be right there, you know, ready to pick off the weak ones, you know? So we have a lot of work to do from a community standpoint, a technological standpoint, and from a community standpoint, like figuring out what our moral floors are, what are our things that, you know, these typical genres of people, you know, that we've boxed people into of, oh, you're a lefty, you're a Democrat, those just don't really exist. They're not helpful anymore. So we need to create our own new kind of social language for deciding that. And I think having these public squares like the Bitcoin blockchain as a database, and then also, you know, the promise of what Twitter, you know, should be, and in many ways is. I mean, Twitter's incredible. It connected me, got me my job. It got me writing. It's connected us. It's connected so many amazing people. There's obviously a lot of work to do there, but, you know, I think public squares are essential for building an alternative. And I think Noster has a lot of cool potential. I'm glad that people are building on it. But there is also an element to like the battlefield is Twitter, you know, like that's where everybody is. So that's where we got to fight for now.
I think this is true, that about the Twitter Nostra thing. I hope it changes at some point, but you're right. For now, this is where we go spend our time. And so we should now, Mark, talk about the role of the state and its thoughts and feelings about Bitcoin. You know, sort of a jilted lover at this point, I would say, for most people. I used to, you know, be interested in the state, and now I just don't want the state to be interested in me anymore. But it doesn't seem to, you know, doesn't seem to be going that way. They keep driving by my house to see what I'm up to. So,
yeah.
So tell me. Maybe we should start with this. So, you know, you said you were kind enough to send me a draft of your book, and
yeah.
There's a, you know, a bit in there about political engagement and whether or not engaging in the political realm when it comes to defending Bitcoin is worth the time. Talk to me about that. What are your thoughts on that subject specifically? Because I see, you know, I'll level with you. I don't know where I stand on this. I think that in the past, I thought it was unwise to spend time with this until I saw that it seemed to me that some politicians were malleable, especially the younger ones. And so we can use influence plus the natural kind of ebb and flow of demographics starting to lean toward us at some point to make the right policy moves. But anyway, I'm curious, what are your thoughts on this, this subject?
Yeah. I mean, I wrote that for a couple of reasons. One, you know, I wrote it at the time where we were coming up on an election, and it was like, I could tell it was becoming an election issue. And partly it's a warning. As much as it is an encouragement. And the warning is, you know, Bitcoin is going to be co-opted. It is co-opted in many ways, by not co-opted in a general systemic sense. Obviously, it's the beauty of it. It's that it really can't be. But, you know, there's a lot of things that can come downstream from what it is that, you know, is going to have a lot of political interest. and, you know, I noticed there a trend happening in the Bitcoin space where, you know, it was really boiling down to very pure single issue voter, and not even single issue in that it was actually about an issue, but it was, do you have a BTC donation address on your campaign website? And that was literally it. And like, people would just, anytime a politician would come out and be like, oh, I like Bitcoin, and then and I donate here. And then it's like, Bitcoiners are like, and it's like, whoa, 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 whoa. Like, hold on. First off, do whatever the hell you want with your Bitcoin. Great. But like, come on, like this is, you know, like, that's not enough. And I'm not saying that, like, I'm not calling out anyone in particular for either supporting people for that or any of the politicians in particular, but just like, guys, like, let's be honest with ourselves. Like, this is, Eric Kaysen has an amazing piece. He's one of my favorite people in the space. And he wrote a piece for us called The Political. And, you know, we've talked about this before, but in some ways I think Bitcoin is like the most apolitical thing ever. And his whole thesis is like, no, it's like the most political substance. It brings us back to the political. And so that piece that I put in the book was kind of just hey, we can choose to or choose not to engage with this reality that's coming. And it's not necessarily making a choice to say one is better than the other, because, like, you know, I think, you know, there's a hell of a lot of truth to what you said at the beginning of, like, I just want the state to leave me alone. And I think a lot of us feel that way. But if all of us Bitcoiners just go disappear into our citadels in the woods and we leave everyone else to just get, you know, eaten by the wolves, you know, have we really done anything? Have we really succeeded at building a better thing if we let our Bitcoin pass with us to the grave and our little citadels? Like, no, I think that's kind of, you know, we want a better world. It's, Bitcoin is a means to an end. And whenever there's a means to an end, the politicians are going to put their hands in it. So let's just talk about it and be honest. And let's ask critical questions of politicians. Are they actually pushing legislation that is good for Bitcoin? Are they educating people about it? Are they making it, you know, available and unfettered access to the Bitcoin network, whether it's mining, unhosted wallets, whatever the political jargon that this, you know, this stupid system generally, you know, pushes back against Bitcoin. It's like, you know, no, let's, if people are going to start accepting Bitcoin donations, let's like make sure that they're really, you know, they're educated, and B, that they're, you know, looking to continue that education to, you know, in a sustainable way, whether it's through public education or just like, you know, making banking rules that allow crypto companies, Bitcoin companies, that allow Bitcoin mining, like whatever it is. So that was a big part of it was, you know, hey, this is a reality. Let's acknowledge it. And then also the other side too is like, hey, you know, kind of getting back to that, like minds coming together over this weird technology. It's like, man, our political parties have failed us pretty much across the board everywhere. I don't really think anyone really feels represented by anybody that's representing anything in the world, really. And that's a humongous blanket statement, but I'm going to stick with it. And it's like, hey, it's our time. You know, if we really, if Bitcoin's going to do what we think it's going to do, and it's going to be worth, you know, eight, nine, 10 figures, whatever, you know, in a very, very long time, when we're all ready to run for president or whatever, you know, hey, we got to, you know, and I'm not talking about myself at all, but it's like, you know, I'm seriously not, of course not. No, hell no. But like, you know, we need to have political Bitcoiners, you know, while the system is, you know, either attempting to attach itself to Bitcoin or, you know, or not. But if it is, you know, I think it's important to have people in there. So it is a little bit of a call to arms, and an opt out. And also, you know, hey, if other people are going to take advantage of Bitcoin and milk this, it's the best brand in the world. Bitcoin is the best brand in the world, the best, number one brand. And, you know, putting it on their fucking, you know, shirt sleeve or whatever is not enough. And so we should all be aware of that and not get bamboozled by this new, you know, people are going to, it's going to be crazy, the co-option that's going to happen. And it's going to be it's going to be a huge political issue, and more so every day. So yeah, just, I guess that was kind of the point. I don't know if I really like have a clear answer. I just know that we need to be careful.
It's a hard question to answer, Mark. And, you know, I appreciate you going into some detail there on your thoughts. And there's, of course, more than one side to this argument. It's a complicated subject. Politics, yeah, by its very nature, is complicated. And the people participating are complicated too, whether they're voting, running, or some combination of the two. So I understand that this is difficult to get a handle on. And that's one of the reasons it's become so appealing to a lot of Bitcoiners, I think. Because if you can make an attempt to kind of corral a certain group of people and have them view things the same way, turn them into a single issue base, for example. Are you a pro Bitcoin politician or are you not a pro Bitcoin politician? There's a lot of power there. Now, I think that there's at the moment probably zero elected officials in the United States and Canada who are explicitly and without a doubt and publicly pro Bitcoin. And so this brings me to my next question. In the United States, especially, Mark, we've seen a bunch of recent snowball attacks on, I'll say, crypto, but I think Bitcoin in the minds of the politicians is very close. And yeah, New York Times obviously put out this piece full of bull about mining and edited photos and like complete insanity. But as you mentioned earlier, there's power and information dissemination. New York Times still has an audience, whether we like it or not.
Amen.
What do you think about the next sort of wave of attacks that's going to come for Bitcoin? Is it going to be in the energy side? Is it going to be in the national security side, which is one I think that's under discussed? I don't agree with Lowry's soft war stuff necessarily, but he's got a good point that national defense has been an ace of spades, a true wild card for US policymakers. Everything falls under that umbrella if it's important enough to the government. And this, I think, will end up getting there at some time. But I'm curious to hear your thoughts. What do you think is coming next for the attackers here?
Yeah, I mean, well, for sure. Yeah, I disagree with Lowry in a lot of ways about a lot of stuff. But I do think obviously there's some reality to what he's talking about to a tiny degree. But also, like, ASIC miners aren't like immune to like nuclear weapons or carpet bombing or anything. It's like, it's pretty easy, actually, I think, to spot a humongous source of power. And, you know, I think that's something that thermal cameras can pick up pretty easily. Like, I don't know if it's just this magical like defense shield thing. Like, I mean, no, it's like a bunch of fucking computers.
Yeah, but did you see the hand-drawn pictures, man? Come on, if that doesn't convince you, I don't know, man. What will?
Yeah. Well, you know, hey, anyway. I mean, I think the next wave of attacks is like, and I'm not calling that this sort of attack, but definitely like, you know, counter operations and military intelligence people kind of getting involved in Bitcoin in big ways. I think the social sort of attacks are less and less. They're more toothless every day. Like how quickly that Greenpeace shit got flipped on its head. And it's just like, and I was upset that so many people were platforming him in a lot of ways because it was so obviously propaganda. But, you know, it was really defeated in a kind of a quick way. So, yeah, I mean, I think we actually have probably, getting back a little bit to the political thing, I think we're actually probably more in danger of what we would perceive as good faith actors. You know, like there's a lot of arguments that maybe like centralization to mining in the United States is a very bad thing for Bitcoin. And no one wants to talk about that. Like maybe it's a good thing that a lot of these mining bans are going through. Like maybe that's good for Bitcoin. Like we should consider that maybe.
Why? I happen to agree with you, but I want to hear what you think. I think this I totally you're right about this.
I mean, it's just like, what are we trying to do here? Are we trying to, you know, and I say the same thing to stablecoin stands and shit. It's like, are we trying to just perpetuate the dollar system and the state that we all hate and we all know and acknowledge are like the biggest terrorist organization in the world, killed more civilians and more Americans than, you know, I mean, than anyone else, you know, the US government has. You know, I think a centralization of mining in the US is arguably bad for censorship resistance within Bitcoin. Again, probabilistically, it's very unlikely that anyone would ever get 51% of the hash. Like, of course, there's so many realities to stacking that many ASICs and, you know, obviously the loss of economic incentive potentially of, you know, censoring blocks. But like, I don't know. I mean, there are big pools in Bitcoin. There is centralization. We need to see some of these tools like Stratum, where we know that Stratum V2, where we know blocks are being, you know, generated, you know, individually rather than a pool operator. So your hash is, you know, you can know that you're not censoring any transactions that aren't that are in your mempool, whereas a mining pool operator could do that. So, you know, we need tools like that are going to help. And then obviously distribution of mining rewards for pools, you know, in a private decentralized way. Is very important because, yeah, I mean, there's an absolute danger of significant hash rate being owned by people we don't like that maybe don't have Bitcoin's best interest in mind. And there is sort of an adage in Bitcoin that everything is good for Bitcoin. And like, man, there's a part of me that like wants to believe that, but it's just like, I can't be that naive and try to be a public figure in Bitcoin and just say shit like that, regurgitate that stuff. It's like, no, there's tons of things that aren't good for Bitcoin. Like there's a tiny attack surface, and that's why we fucking love Bitcoin, because it's this it's this thing. You know, I'm glad we don't have to deal with, you know, the non-native asset of stablecoins is now the heaviest, you know, asset. And now if you know, Ethereum wants to fork, they have to get a blessing from Jeremy Allaire or whatever. It's like, yeah, I'm glad we don't have to deal with that shit. We have a smaller attack surface, which is awesome, but there's still attack surfaces. And probably the main one that I can really think it, you know, is a potential serious problem is you know, an attack on the censorship resistance quality of Bitcoin by, you know, taking hash rate and making it so you have to wait longer to and pay more to, you know, less popular mining pools to get your like OFAC non-compliant transactions through. And there is a beauty to Bitcoin that anyone can find a block and like, you know, hey, no one's are people really going to give up like 100 sat per V byte, you know, black market transactions? Like I would assume a miner will take those juicy fees, but you know, having a humongous amount of hash in the US, you know, could potentially lead to a bunch of regulatory bullshit. And distribute Bitcoin around the world. You know, it's like we saw what happened from a geopolitical standpoint when they banned mining in China and like where they all went, how they distributed through Asia, and through Europe. And so like, what would a Bitcoin mining ban look like if it happened in the US? Like, it might actually be really good for Bitcoin in the long term and be really bad in the short term for all of our bags. And again, I don't want the state to do anything. I really want them to leave Bitcoin alone. You know, but like, I think that they're, I think the political pundit sort of like pushing towards, you know, let's make Bitcoin, or America, like, you know, the Bitcoin mining capital of the world, certainly North America. I'm not necessarily sure that's such a great thing for the ultimate decentralization of the network.
I think that's probably true. I would like to see a resurgence in home mining as well. I think it's good for people to understand what goes into mining, validation, things like that, especially new coiners who truly are here, you know, more than ever before as either a lottery ticket or a lifeboat. Yeah, I think that's where people are coming into the space now. And it's our job to, isn't our job to kind of bring them on board and tell them the right stuff, right?
Absolutely.
And so part of that is the decentralization mission. And I don't understand why Hut 8 needs a million A6 in North America. I don't understand why, you know, I love Pierre. He's, you know, he's a friend of the show, but like, why? What is the benefit? What is the benefit of Riot running a huge operation in Texas and pushing back against MIT? Like, long term, and maybe we can go here next. Long term, Bitcoin is going to have a lot of different challenges that are difficult to forecast, to say the least. And
totally,
you know, you've given some thought to this. I haven't given that much thought to it, Mark. I really don't know even where to start when I kind of sit down and think about this stuff or read about it. One of the things that you're writing about in your book is this post-issuance era of Bitcoin. And we've had a lot of people on the show in the past who have an opinion on this. We've had guys from you know, guys from the mining space. We've had guys from the economic space. We had Doomberg and Mike Green on last summer. Both of them have concerns about post-issuance Bitcoin network security and maintenance. And so I want to know,
shaking his head,
I want to know, tell me more. What do you think about
post-issuance Bitcoin? I'll get him. No, obviously huge respect to everybody. But no, I mean, obviously, you know, let's just throw the caveat out right away that, you know, no one has any idea what's going to happen. And anyone that does is a charlatan lying to you. But I know what's going to happen. No, but I have some ideas. And I think that there's, you know, a lot of the security budgeter, you know, kind of bullshit. Yeah, it's the best. It kind of doesn't make a lot of logical sense. It's like Bitcoin either monetizes or it doesn't. Bitcoin either has billions of users or it doesn't. The block space is like we've already I think maybe crossed a point of no return with, you know, there will always just be an extended raft of transactions waiting to go in. But it's always going to be a variable fee market, obviously. And as issuance goes down and down, you know, the relative economic cost of mining a block will obviously go towards, you know, fees. And if Bitcoin has even close to a billion users, the block, you know, space will be filled every 10 minutes, absolutely, no matter what. And I think that might already kind of somewhat be the case already. And a lot of people bring up this idea of like, oh, well, everything's going to be on layer twos or maybe even layer threes and no one's going to settle on the main chain and like Lightning ruined Bitcoin or whatever. I don't know if people say that, but you know, they go to that kind of extreme and it's just like you're kind of missing the economic realities of what Bitcoin is. And it's a database and you pay sat per byte, per V byte of your transaction to get your transaction into the next block. And so a main chain Bitcoin transaction is weighted. Its value is based on the size of the transaction in terms of byte size. That has absolutely nothing to do with the size of the transaction from a value standpoint. You know, you could send, you know, like the you could pay the exact same fee for a $1 transaction as a $1 billion transaction. Mm-hmm. That's not true on layer twos and shared UTXO models. You know, you're basically paying a yield for short-term liquidity on a routing route, you know, to get to your final destination, and you're paying based on the literal transactional size and how much yield you need to be able to transfer your satoshis, you know, to your receiver. And so actually it's economically incentivized to settle on the main chain, for high level, you know, high value transactions, because it's actually probably going to be cheaper to settle a one plus Bitcoin transaction on main chain than it would be on Lightning. And obviously Lightning's, you know, routing capabilities will continue to grow. But that economic concept will always be true. So this idea that like we're just going to completely go off to layer two and there will be no issuance and no one will mine. It's like, well, if that's true, then Bitcoin's died. I mean, it's dead. And Bitcoin is an experiment and it could fail. I don't think it will. I'm obviously betting extremely so that it won't fail. And I'm much more, I think it's much more likely that other systems that we rely on will fail before Bitcoin will. So it either monetizes or it doesn't. And I think we'll know long before issuance is done if it's monetized or not. I actually think we'll know probably by the end of the decade. You know, if there really are, you know, an active user base, because that's what it's all about. It's about users, you know, paying the market fee to get their transaction in a block. And that's going to be the case no matter what, even if there's issuance or no issuance. And I think Bitcoin was incredibly cleverly designed to, you know, be considered a you know, an inflating kind of lossy, you know, oh, 50 Bitcoin every 10 minutes. Here we go. 50% of all Bitcoin ever issued coming out. We'll give it to poker players. We'll give it to drug dealers. We'll distribute it across the world. Next halving, 25% more. And it's like slowly the ideals of like, wait a minute, this is like, we're going to have every 210,000 blocks, we're going to cut issuance in half again. Oh my goodness. There's absolute scarcity in an infinite universe, basically infinite universe. Like this is a one-time kind of holy shit. And so its monetary, you know, capabilities have changed with the reality of its relative issuance. And I think it's no mistake that it was used as a medium of exchange predominantly in its early years, because that's what it was as a money. That's what it was best for. And so we're like seeing this sort of thing play out. If it was always a scarce thing when it came out, the first person, whoever came across it, would have thrown it all in their security box, their lock box, and never distributed it. And that's something that John Nash talked about in his Ideal Money, was this idea of the lock box singularity. Like you can't have money that's too scarce. It needs to be able to, you know, be distributed. Well, then if you're going to have monetary inflation, you know, how do you, you know, kind of wean off the issuance? Oh, we have this asymptotic approach to zero where, you know, if this is the target rate, let's cut it in half, cut it in half, cut it in half. And now we're in that moment where like, you know, big institutions and world players are realizing, oh shit, there's only a couple percent left of these Bitcoin to snack up. And of course we'll have distribution. That's something that's innate to Bitcoin. That's why it's like better, or not innate to Bitcoin, but compared to like proof of stake alternatives and stuff.
Exactly.
Like you can't just hold the Bitcoin and get the yield on it. You need to distribute it to get economic power out of it. And not only when you distribute it, the receiver who gets the Bitcoin, it's going to be worth more. You know, we always get paid and our value is always going down if we get paid in fiat money. You know, it's your money is the most valuable when you get it. That's a principle of the Cantillon effect, is that the first people to get it, it's the most valuable right when you get it. And then as more gets printed, it distribute, you know, it loses purchasing power. Bitcoin's the total opposite. So it really is this like huge state change. Yeah, I don't even know where we started there, but I think Mark
still left it there. I really like, and the thing that I think people don't understand about the halving, especially new people, Len and I and D from CoinKite went to do a talk yesterday, and
cool.
It's a lot of, what's the best way to put this? The questions are in good faith.
Yeah.
But it's people who just don't understand, like, why would I want something? You know, what am I going to do when there's no more Bitcoin coming out? I'm going to divide it into more, you know, like it's going to, I got to go down the decimal chain a little bit. And, you know, how do I get Bitcoin if there's no cash? It's amazing to me that there seems to be such a lack of understanding about what value means in a monetary system, as if the money should just come to you for nothing at some rate all the time. The faucet's always on. There's always a drip. Whether you're on welfare, whether you're working, it doesn't matter. The money's always coming in at some rate. To tell people that they don't have this option in Bitcoin, that no one's going to give you this money because it is the hardest money. They will give you everything else first. It's a totally weird conversation. It's a weird conversation to have, isn't it? I think we found that in... Yeah, I mean, we'll deal with that.
It's a misunderstanding of what money is. And it's like literally the dollar has become like a brand and a religion and a lifestyle and all this bullshit. But like, you know, again, to get back to Nash, you know, he wrote this paper in the mid 50s called The Bargaining Problem. And it talks about, you know, okay, there's two bargainers in this scenario. And there are a multitude, looking at it from a game theoretical standpoint, there are multiples of outcomes that could occur when two people come together and try to bargain. And the way that you actually limit the number of positive outcomes for both parties involved in a maximum way is by using a medium of exchange, some sort of common currency that can be, you know, basically a risk minimizer for potential outcomes. If you're trying to trade two apples for a bicycle or whatever, it's like, okay, well, maybe you're really hungry and you need to eat that thing, and that trade makes sense for this. And then, or maybe you need the bicycle to go get more food or what. I don't know. There's some instances where those things could be very beneficial for either side, depending on the context, and also very dangerous and bad of a trade, depending on the context. And so money is this technological tool that was created to minimize you know, these messed up outcomes between people bargaining, and it is a technological tool. And Bitcoin is, yeah, it's a sort of a state change from what we have lived in our entire lives of fiat money, of easy money, of ZERP, you know, zero interest rate policy. You know, that's, you know, we used to get, you know, interest rate in our checkings accounts and stuff, like our, you know, in the Volcker days, like in the '80s or whatever, it's like, you could get, you know, nearly double digit, you know, yields in an account. That's crazy. And that was a great savings mechanism for people that were on the dollar. You know, that was great. Why would you take your money out of the dollar system? It's like that's why they call it the interest rate. You know, the higher it is, the more interest you have in it. You're making more yeah. money, baby. Yeah. I don't think that's why they call it the interest rate. But that's
good. Yeah, you should market that. Print a hat. That can be in your next hat, maybe. Next interview.
Yeah. I gotta start making hats. But yeah, like money really is this technological tool. And yeah, we've gotten so used to free money. And like, I think 2008 was like a systemic example of like, none of this matters at all. We're not going to put anyone in jail that just ruined millions of people's lives with these ridiculous CDOs. We're going to bail them all out, give them huge bonuses, start hiring them as, you know, secretary treasuries, or, you know, in the case of Mnuchin. I mean, that whole shit is
people,
so crazy,
people
dude.
Forget like, about that. Like,
it's crazy.
Nuts.
And right before that happened, when Kamala Harris, our now VP, was the head DA in California, it was her job, and it came across her desk whether or not she wanted to prosecute Steve Mnuchin. She said, of course, no.
Unbelievable. That
Unbelievable.
Picture of
it's Purple Party.
And his wife with the money is like, that's like the best.
Yeah.
That, when history reflects on the fall of the American empire, okay,
mm-hmm.
it's going to be Big Macs and that picture.
Yeah.
Those are the two things that's going to be in every textbook. This guy was at the top of the food chain when it came to monetary policy. This is the photo he decided was in good taste at that time. That's how untouchable these guys felt.
100%.
And it's completely nuts to me. That photo drives me. I gotta get that printed and put it somewhere in this room.
The Purple Party bullshit of the United States is crazy. And I know I've talked about this in some pods recently, but like, you look at every important interest rate manipulator, you know, from Volcker to Jerome, and they were nominated by one political party and renominated by the other. Every single one since the late 70s and Volcker. Every single one except Yellen, because she was in for too short a period of time. But every single one was nominated by one party, renominated by the other. Sometimes twice. In Greenspan's case, he was older Bush, Clinton. You know, like, he went back and forth because he did like 20. You know, four terms or something. The longest Fed chair ever. But yeah, it's like, so we've lived in this free money, you know, world for so long that it's like, and people have thrown out all these things, you know, of UBIs and the bailouts, you know, of 2020 CARES Act and the extended one that they did the year later. You know, a lot of us like just like got checks for thousands of dollars. You know, like all my friends that were working in bars and working in, you know, restaurants, hotels and whatever, or artists, all my gigging friends. You know, it was like all of a sudden it was like, oh, I can fill out a form and I can get $4,000 to, or, you know, whatever. And it's like, when something like that happens, there's like a, you know, yeah, like I'm not surprised that, you know, then we start to see this quiet quitting bullshit, and we start to see people that are literally operating three remote from home jobs, work from home jobs at the same time. And like, you know, just a bunch of crazy shit that you just, you know, and then of course, you know, it's coupled with this ridiculous, you know, bull market that we've had for, you know, so long of just easy money. It's just like, you know, literally we got fucking Dave Portnoy going on with a green hammer and he's just slamming and he's like, it always goes up. And he was right. And he like built an empire out of the most ridiculous shit for always being right. And it's like, that is a zero interest rate policy phenomenon. And like Bitcoin obviously took advantage of that. I mean, it 20x'd in a year, you know, because of economic policy, financial policy. But yeah, there isn't really a free lunch in Bitcoin. And there were back in the day, again, to the point of the financial policy of it changing, there were faucets that, you know, Gavin Andreessen set up a faucet where you could go get, you know, 5 Bitcoin. You know, there's funny, like, you know, there's a pretty good meme circulating, or not meme, but just an image circulating of like a StarCraft tournament in like 2011 or 2010 or something. And it's like, you know, first prize, $500, second prize, $250, third prize, $100, fourth place. And it's like fourth place through like fifth place or something, or through 10th place. It's like, you get 25 Bitcoin. And it's just like, you know, that's just like wild. And so, yeah, I think people are really noticing, you know, and I'm not necessarily always the biggest fan, but you know, when you see like a sailor who's like making a ridiculous speculative attack on the US dollar, you know, and it's like, oh, there's a reason why he's blowing out all this debt and, you know, and he's finally in the green now or whatever, but it's like, you start to see more and more of that happening. And, the scarcity mindset is like a FOMO thing. And the reality of number go up is huge. I mean, price drives every narrative really.
So, We're over time, but I got to ask you one more question before I ask you the one we ask everyone. What is the number you think where more people, because we talked about this yesterday and everyone thinks about this, right? Everyone talks about currencies failing and we're not alone in this, Mark. Like, I think people are doing this, whether they're in Bitcoin or not. You're watching currencies fail. Gold is hitting all time highs. It just hit an all time high in Canadian dollars last week. Yeah, you guys are pushing 2025, I think, last I checked, per ounce of gold. Obviously, in some of these developing nations where currencies have completely been destroyed, Bitcoin and gold are hitting all-time highs together. Yeah. And so the natural question, I think, for a lot of people is, well, why would I ever trade my dollars for Bitcoin? Why would anyone take Bitcoin instead of dollars? Well, at some point, the number is going to hit a sum that, even if you don't understand anything about Bitcoin, you have to ask yourself, why am I still taking Canadian? Why am I still taking USD? Why am I still taking the euro? And so, you know, maybe a fun question here before we wrap up, what do you think the number is? What is the fire alarm number? Again, to go back to Luke's analogy, for me, you know, I think people talk about 100K an awful lot. There's a nice sort of round number wall there for people mentally and, you know, probably emotionally, spiritually, whatever.
Yeah.
But if the price gets up to 75 or 80 again, I really think that's when you start to run the risk of currencies in the sort of at the CAD tier, the Canadian dollar tier.
Totally.
Some of these, yeah, you know what I mean? Like those currencies start to wobble a bit. What do you think? What's the number?
Well, yeah, I mean, 100%. I think, money and currency is like a trust game, especially fractional reserved fiat, you know, that we have now. And so I do think that there will be sort of a fulcrum, you know, where we pass something. I think if I had to pick a number or anything like that, I think it would just be always relative to the previous cycle. Cause I think that's kind of the psychological, it's like, oh, we went down 80% again, but it's like, oh, but we just passed 20K. Oh my. And then we just rip through it, you know? And then it's like, bam, we're at 69 and you know, 6 months later or whatever. So I think the psychological number, I think every time Bitcoin recovers from, cause every time it's, oh, here come the obituaries, here come the, you know, here's the New Orleans funeral march, it's Bitcoin's dead again or whatever. And then it fundamentally breaks through the previous cycle's high, which is a chart porn moment or whatever. Yeah. And then you can't ignore that stuff. Cause then you're in uncharted territory and it's like, okay, well, if we are sort of in a way acknowledging Bitcoin is like kind of this only scarce thing that exists, and you know, fiat is just the opposite of that. I think there will be a mindset change, but like, again, also it's like, why wouldn't you keep taking dollars If you can, you know, we have the technology generally to be able to auto convert that stuff pretty quickly. Like, I don't think the dollar will go away all that quickly in terms of like from an accounting standpoint or a payroll standpoint, because there is a stability there. But the second that stability goes, I mean, if we do see, I mean, and again, like we've seen it. I mean, we've seen inflationary effects. It's crazy out here. Crazy. Yeah. But it hasn't like prevented people from like heating their homes yet or like feeding their kids. Like it's right at this like breaking point.
It's close.
Oh, no, of course. And I don't mean to minimize anyone that is going through that, diminish that experience, because I mean, that's so messed up. But like, generally things haven't broken that as much as you would really think. I mean, obviously lockdowns and shit, that's a totally different thing, but like in terms of just financial policy, like, yeah, eggs got expensive, gas got really expensive, but like people were more like, you know, the middle class hasn't gotten destroyed yet. It's like very hurt, and it could get destroyed very quickly with some bad things. Real estate market goes bust in any way, I mean, the middle class is completely wiped out. And I think that probably will happen. So I don't know exactly what the number is, other than I think if when we break 69, that double top again, I think that will, you know, all eyes will be on Bitcoin. Every time there's a headline of, you know, new all-time high, you know, that's I think more important than the number.
So you heard it here first. 69,420 is Mark Goodwin's number. And so Mark, I gotta say, you've been a great guest. Real fireball here. We like to see our guests rolling downhill. You did a lot of that tonight, which is fantastic. Now, before you go, okay?
Yeah.
You know what I'm gonna ask you? Do you have any idea?
I do not. No.
Yeah.
Everyone
listens to the beginning of the show to see what they're into, but they never make it to the end. Okay.
The people who
watch the CBP, Mark. Okay. They know what the next question is.
All right. Well, lay it on me, brother.
If you and CK are in a parking lot side by side, okay? And 40 yards away, you guys are wearing your favorite running shoes, shirts, tank tops, whatever, okay? You're geared up to run.
Okay.
40 yards away is the finish line. Can you take Christian in a foot race 40 yards? And if you can,
man,
how much you beating him by?
I think CK, that's really the last question you ask every guest.
That's what we ask everyone. I just asked Preston. Preston came on last week, like I said.
Specifically CK?
I didn't ask CK. I don't ask everyone about CK. But like we had Jeff and Saifedean on last year, Jeff Booth and Saifedean.
Yeah.
And I asked them about Preston. And both of them, without hesitation, said they would crush Preston in a foot race. No hesitation. And so Preston, I asked Preston about Mike Saylor. We'll see if Mike Saylor ever makes it into your seat to talk about Preston's foot speed.
Let's go.
For tonight, are you willing to talk about whether or not you could take CK in a 40-yard dash?
I am going to say that CK is, I think, probably sneaky athletic. I know he's I feel like he's like a lot more sneakily athletic than I am sneakily athletic. You know, I'm more of the like good high, you know, hand eye coordination, good instincts, that heart of a champion.
You're a real grinder.
But a 40 yard dash, Jerry. I think I'm going to give it to the lean, mean grilling machine, CK.
I think
he's going to take it. I'm a very self-confident man. You know, if it's who's going to hit a 3-pointer to win the game, I think I'm taking myself. But a 40 yard dash is a very specific athletic skill that I don't think I really have any business gloating about. I can go walk 10 miles and not break a sweat. You know, give me some distance stuff. 40 yards? No, I don't think so, pal. I'm gonna give it to CK.
We'll have to get him on. We can talk about that. We'll give him. I'll clip it and I'll tag him in the tweet. So, Mark, before you go, tell people where they can find you. Bitcoin Magazine, floor's all yours, buddy.
Yeah, totally. And thanks again, Joey. And yeah, give some love to Len. You know. Really happy to be on here. A lot of fun. You know, I work at Bitcoin Magazine, obviously. You can follow us at Bitcoin Magazine. We also have a print handle that I help with the editorial there with Joe Rogers and Annabelle and, you know, a whole bunch of other savages over there. Please support the magazine. You know, incredible contributors. Please write something, send something in. And you can obviously follow me at Mark Goodwin with an underscore under the W and the IN, and look up on a Bitcoin Magazine store in the next, I don't know, few months or so. The Bitcoin Dollar Book will be dropping. So, and of course, you know, see you in Miami.
Absolutely. We're looking forward to it. Thanks everyone for listening, watching. We'll talk to you when we talk to you. Take care. Way to go. Good show, buddy.
Boom.
Good show.
Dude. So. Well-